Think about the day that you popped the question, guys. Do you remember that day? The tightness in the pit of your stomach? The nervousness? The idea, what if she looks at me and says, "Oh, honey, no." Which was a real terror to me. Maybe some of you weren't afraid of that. How you plan for days, months ahead of time. You had the ring. You had envisioned all this romanticizing that you know what was going to be perfect about that moment that you actually popped the question. And you finally said, "Honey, will you marry me?" I want to take just a moment before we get to that "I do" to ask the question, what does it mean to say, "I do"? Before we actually walk that altar, brethren, we need to know what it means. And let me say, if you've already walked the aisle, if you've already said those words, you need to go back and revisit their meaning and the impact that they have on your lives. What is the meaning of "I do"? It seems that today's modern marriage culture, every "I do" comes with some sort of quick caveat. Qualifiers. "I do as long as our love lasts," as some of those modern marriage vows are going. "I do as long as your skin is smooth or your hair hangs on." "I do as long as you change the toilet paper roll and put the seat up or down." "I do as long as your little habits don't shred my nerves or your brain-rotting conversation doesn't numb my resolve. I do unless or until something better comes along." Over and over and over again, we see marriages that last only that are getting out of the starting gate and last for just a moment and are as gone as quickly as they came. When my internet boots up, Fox News is my homepage. I noticed yesterday there was a headline. Didn't click on the story. Didn't really have a temptation to click on the story, but it was saying that Pamela Anderson was going down the aisle for the fourth time. Hollywood is famous for its firework marriages, you know. They come in with a bang and they last about as long. It doesn't take long for them to move to the next wife and the next wife and the next wife. But what does it really mean to say "I do"? I have in the margin of my Bible the marriage sermon that I normally preach. "I blank take you blank." Not that both of their mothers named them blank, but I fill in the blank with the name of the person that I'm reading this to. "Take you to be my lawfully wedded wife or husband, to have and to hold in riches and in poverty, in sickness and in health, to love, honor, and cherish until we are parted in death." Something along those lines. And yet that "death do us part," or "parted in death," is being taken out of the marriage every day of our society. Let us this morning look at how God has infused fidelity, faithfulness, commitment into the marriage covenant. Let us cultivate the matrimonial garden, as it were, and yield blissful fruits that are pleasing to God. That's the commitment we need to be making. You'll notice in the book there's 3 points that we're going to be looking at. One is contemplation. The second is completion. And then the third is commitment. Contemplation, that is the process in which we begin to think about what marriage means for us. It is the process of determining a suitable companion. When we go all the way back to Genesis chapter 2, when God is instituting from the divine record, The origin of the home, as Brother Young mentioned this morning, as he's spelling out what man is supposed to look for in the marriage. He says specifically in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 18, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him an help fit for him, one that is meet for his purposes in life." God realizes that it's not good that man should go through this life without companionship. It is not the ideal. And what I find so amazing is that God took the time to go through all the animals of the garden to search for that companion, brought them to Adam, and Adam, as he's naming them, realizes there's not one that is suitable for him. And that's when God caused the sleep to fall upon Adam and created woman. Created her in such a way that she would complete man. You know the two words, complement, one with an I and one with an E. The one with an E comes from the root complete. Because that is what man and woman do for one another. They complete one another. Now notice as we look at in Genesis chapter 2, not only does God bring the woman to the man, but he takes her as his wife. But it is God choosing the mate. God has always chosen our mate. Did you realize that? Look in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 3 through 4, as he is telling the children of Israel who they can marry and who they can't. Remember, he tells them, "You shall not intermarry with them," talking about these foreign nations. He goes on to tell them, don't take their sons as husbands for your daughters. Don't take their daughters as wives for your sons. In fact, he tells them why in the very next verse. He says, "For they would turn away your sons from following me." God is interested in being part of the contemplation process. Who is my suitable mate? In Genesis 24, after the servant has been sent away to find the wife for Jacob, he begins to pray to God and he says, "Lord, let her be the one that comes and lowers the water down, or lowers the pitcher down and gets the water," and he goes through all the things, the criteria that he sees as a sign. "And when I see that woman," he says, "then I will know that you have shown steadfast love to my master." Here is a man who trusted in God's decision of matchmaking. You know, on this earth, we like to play matchmaker, don't we? A lot of people like to be involved. Well, you know, they're only married because I introduced them 5 years ago. We want to be matchmakers. God wants to be a matchmaker too. And it's time we start inviting God into the process and trusting His decision. It's not enough to pray, "God, help me find the perfect spouse. God, help me find the one that is going to be strong where I am weak. Help me find the one who is going to show the emotions that I cannot show, or handle the situations that I cannot handle. God, help me find that person." And then when God brings that person into our lives, say, "God, don't worry about it, I found someone else." And that's exactly what some people are doing. They invite him in and then they don't trust his decision. Every Sunday evening before our evening worship services begin, we have the little kids, fifth grade and down. And we've got them down to 2 years old, some of them even younger than that if their parents are sitting with them. And they come down to the front and we sing a few songs and we go through some special chapters of the Bible. Like, you know, I can say creation and they'll tell you Genesis 1. I talk about heaven, I say heaven, and they'll give you Revelation 21, go through all these things, and I end with three questions. And I guarantee you, anyone from sitting from West Hill there knows the three questions, and they know the answers. In fact, the kids know the questions. Same three questions. I don't change it. And as I'm starting, I'll say there's three questions that I'm going to ask. And these kids are jumping like this because they want to answer the question. They don't just want to answer, they want to ask the question. I'll say, what's the first one? What's the definition of success? Oh, they're so excited. And then I'll turn to someone else and what's the answer? To live your life so you can go to heaven. What's the definition of failure? To live your life so you don't go to heaven. And that third question. When I grow up, I'm going to marry. And they yell it out, a Christian! I'm going to marry a Christian. Why? Because God is interested in who we marry. And when we start looking for that suitable mate, we need to start looking first and foremost at those who are children of God, who share a like precious faith with myself. Why start behind the eight ball when you can start ahead of the game? Think about how relationships, as we're contemplating marriage and what it means to say I do, realize that every relationship we have affects our faith. From the relationship that we have with the gas station clerk, to the relationship that we have with our parents. But nowhere is it more noticed than the relationship we have with our spouse. That relationship will affect our faith more than any other relationship that we will ever have on this earth. And I will say this, it can be for good or for bad. No relationship has a neutral effect on you. You may say, well, you know, that gas station attendant, he doesn't have a whole lot of effect on my faith. I don't know, have you tried to share the gospel with him? Because if you hadn't, that's affecting your faith. And if you have, that's affecting your faith. And when it comes to marriage, the person that you're going to be spending the most time with, hopefully, they're going to impact your faith. And so, as we're wondering, you know, what kind of person, or you know, how are they going to affect my faith? We first are going to ask, you know, what kind of spouse will he or she be? Is this going to be the kind of spouse that is going to encourage me to worship God? Or will he tempt me to forsake God? Will she be open to Bible study? Is he hostile to God? Or is he receptive to his teaching? Does she already have some strong faith and deep attachment to some man-made religion or sect of this world? You know, these are questions that we need to ask. What sacrifices will I have to make in order to marry that spouse? Are we compatible, spiritually speaking? What philosophy do they have when it comes to marriage, to God, to raising children? See, these are the most important questions that we're going to ask. And most importantly, when I'm asking what kind of spouse will she be, or for the young ladies, what kind of spouse will he be? Is she going to help me get to heaven? Or is she going to hold me back? You see, we're putting ourselves in the role of the prophet asking that question. What kind of person will this spouse be? And really, before we can answer that, we've got to answer another question, don't we? It's what kind of spouse will I be? See, we need to know who we are. We need to know the strength of our faith. Need to know the direction of our steps. We need to know who we are emotionally, intellectually, physically, spiritually. We need to know who we are so that we can look for someone to complete this puzzle. If we don't know what the puzzle looks like, it makes it that much harder to complete the puzzle, doesn't it? Well, half the puzzle's right here. And if I don't know what this looks like, it's going to be hard for me to find that spouse that God has chosen for me that's going to complement me. These are the things that we've got to think about. Before we drop to the knee and say, will you marry me? Much less before we get to the altar and say, I do. These are questions that we have to answer if we're going to at all be successful in our marriages. What kind of spouse will I be? And hopefully, in our Bible classes, in our pulpits across the country and throughout the world, but most especially from the recliner in the den, they have heard lessons on what kind of spouse you need to be and what kind of spouse to look for. So we start to complicate or contemplate what does it mean to say, I do. But I do also has the idea of completion. I've already touched a little bit on it, but think about how marriage is the completion as we are weeding out all the detrimental things of everyone that is out there. Finding the one that is going to complement or complete this puzzle. We go all the way back to the Garden of Eden. We see that marriage was born out of Adam and Eve being pulled from the furnace like two bars of white hot iron. And they're joined together and hammered and molded and forged together into marriage. And just as these two bars were struck together and bent and folded and bent and folded repeatedly, now they've become one inseparable bar of iron. Not easily broken. Impossible to separate fully. That's marriage. We traditionally here in our country, we have the lighting of the unity candle, right? You ever thought about how the flames come together to form that one? And while that flame cannot ever truly be separated, we can take out of it other light. We could extinguish that light. But how do you separate a flame? How do you separate a marriage? In Genesis 2 and verse 23 again, here Adam looks at the woman and he says, this is at last bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. He looks at her and he sees this is the complement to who I am. God intended marriage to complete the man. To finish man, not to finish him off, but to finish man. So that they, when they came together emotionally, where one was strong and the other might be weak, they can come together and form a stronger bond. Intellectually, physically, and yes, that is in reference to the sexual intimacy in the marriage. God created man and woman to fit one another, right? I will make a helper fit for him. And greatest of all is that God has created us to complement one another spiritually. To help one another to get to heaven. That's what God wants to see in our lives. Think about how, here's Adam saying, this is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. You know, Paul and Peter and the apostles, when they dealt with the concept of marriage, they were also putting together the puzzle pieces showing how men and women fit together. In Ephesians 5 verse 23 says that the husband is the head of the wife. And we say, well, wives, make sure your husband's your head. But let me give you the flip side of that too. Husbands, make sure you are the head. I've seen too many wives that have come and to talk and say, I want him to take the leadership. I want him to be the head in our family. And here's a man over here who just does not want that responsibility. And sometimes we hear women chided for not allowing their husbands be the head of the family. And sometimes it's because their husbands won't be the head of family and someone's got to take the lead. And they feel exasperated and they have no idea what to do. And we simply chide them. Well, you can't be the head of your house. Which is equivalent to saying, make sure your house has no spiritual direction whatsoever. just a few verses later in Ephesians 5 and verse 25, it says, husbands, love your wives. Husbands, love your wives. Well, then wives, you need to so act that you are easy to love. And still further, at the end of the context, in Ephesians 5:33, says that wives need to respect their husbands. Okay? Then husbands, live respectably. It's hard to respect some men, isn't it? You see how they live their lives? How much easier it would be if men would live in a respectable way. And that's when their wives would respect them. Peter joins the discussion. We don't have time to go through all through these, but I encourage you to read Ephesians 5, verses 22 through the end of the chapter, and 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 12 or so. Wonderful passages on husband-wife relationships. But it says to husbands that they are to honor the women as the weaker vessel. Then women need to live honorably. You see how they complement one another? You know that there's people in your life that you respect because they live in a respectable way. There are people you honor because they live honorably. You also know there's people that you've met or that you know that it's hard to pay honor to them because they do not live honorably, right? We complement, we complete one another when we begin to truly honor and respect one another. And so this completion is that we come together and we merge our strengths and our weaknesses. And that's part of going back to the first point of knowing who you are as a spouse. If you know who you are as a spouse, you know not only your strengths, but you do know your weaknesses. And anyone who's honest with themselves as a spouse or as a person knows you have weaknesses. And so what do? You look for someone who's strong in that area. A very simplified example would be, if you're not very good in math, it might be wise of you to marry someone who's good in math so the checkbook will be balanced. Right? That seems pretty simple, doesn't it? If you have a hard time with conflict and you shy away from it constantly and you want to avoid all trouble, it might be wise to find someone who can discipline your children. Right? Some conflict there. Conflict resolution. I'm not asking you to marry someone that's going to beat you. I'm asking you to marry someone who can deal with the conflict that comes up in every home. If you cannot do it, be honest with yourself. If you cannot do it, find a spouse that can. So we merge together our strengths and our weaknesses. And as we merge those together, we do something else that's important, and that is we meet each other's needs. Every one of us has needs. We may have slightly different needs. But as a person, I want someone who is going to, number one, recognize my needs, and number two, strive to meet those needs. And the converse of that, whenever I meet someone, I find out what it is that makes them tick and the needs that they have, and then I strive to meet their needs. I'm sure you've heard of the book, His Needs, Her Needs. One of the greatest reads outside the Bible that I've ever had. In which he identifies man's greatest needs, or men's greatest needs, and women's greatest needs. And through his years of counseling, he shows how most men follow a certain pattern, and most women follow a certain pattern. And the tragedy is, when he's dealing with families that are breaking apart, is that man has tried to meet every one of his wife's needs, thinking her needs were the same as his. And she has done everything possible to meet all of his needs, thinking his needs were the same as hers. In other words, she was meeting her own personal needs for him, That he didn't value as much as the needs that he had, that she was not meeting. And many times that causes the relationship to crumble, piece at a time. And so complementing one another is coming together, recognizing, and this is through communication, through knowing one another. Not just intimacy in the physical side, but intimacy in the intellectual side. To talk and discuss. So that together you can meet one another's needs. And then finally, when I say I do, I'm making a commitment. When I say I do, I've already contemplated what it means to be a good spouse and what I'm looking for. I've already looked at how they complement one another. But now, when I say I do, I'm putting myself in the role of making a commitment. Think again about Genesis 2. This time in verse 24. He says, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Think about that. To hold fast. To latch onto something and not let go. And they become one flesh. But you know, that takes commitment. Jesus did not see that being on an equality with God was something to be held on to or grasped. But rather let go, allowing himself to take upon him the form of a servant, right? Philippians 2. He let go. We are to prove all things and hold fast those things that are good. Paul is telling us, don't let go. In the institution of marriage, he says, when you find your wife or when you find your husband, don't let go. Because you see, it's a choice. We choose to be in love with or not be in love with someone. We need to have that shouted from every pulpit. This idea that I fell in love and I fell out of love as if it's some happy accident that has been drilled into our children's head from Walt Disney specials to the classroom to other movies to novels, that I fall in love and I fall out of love. When God said, love your brothers, he didn't say fall in love with your brothers and fall out of love with brothers. He said choose to love. When he said love me, he didn't say fall in love with me and fall out of love with me, whatever whim strikes you at this moment. He said choose to love me. And when you say I do, you are making a choice to love that person. In riches and in poverty, in sickness and in health. Until you're parted in death. Jesus echoes the same sentiment in Matthew chapter 19. Beginning in verse 6, he says, he tells them what God has joined together. Using the same language, or prefacing with the same language, the two shall become one flesh. What God therefore has joined together, let not man separate. Don't let man come along and choose to separate it. Let man follow the choice of holding fast what God joined together. I know this because he continues in verse 9. And tells us that whoever divorces his wife, except it be for fornication, and marries another, commits adultery. He made the choice to marry her at I do. He made the choice to stop loving her at I don't. And he made the choice to love someone else when he said, I do again. So it's a commitment that is born out of the choices that we make. And what does that mean? That commitment says that I am going to be physically intimate with my spouse. And that's not just the sexual relations. That's the touching, the reassurance, the security that comes from a hug, or just sitting next to each other in the booth at the restaurant. Don't deprive one another of that kind of physical intimacy. And it's not just the physical intimacy that comes into play here. It's the emotional intimacy. How often have you heard of marriages that went south because the man or the woman found more emotional connection with somebody else? Somebody at work. Some neighbor. Another parent from the school. Because they took greater emotional interest in this person, they were able to separate a marriage. Or, what about our intellectual? You know, we need to have some stimulating conversation with one another. Not just a, "Hi, hun, how was your day? Did you get the kids fed? Is the house clean?" But intellectual conversations. Political views. Doctrinal discussions. Sometimes we men especially get into the rut of, I only need information from my wife. I get my intellectual stimulation from my buddies. How to tie a fishing fly. What kind of gun to hunt with. Now that's my intellectual stimulation. We need to start having some intellectual stimulation from our spouses, from our wives. And, spiritually speaking, we need to have a spiritual intimacy that husbands and wives can pray together, that they read the scriptures together, that they dwell upon the word of God together. Now, it's not wrong to have physical contact with other people. I can't tell you how many people I've given hugs to today. That means I'm all covered in germs and everything. So if you're a germaphobe, don't hug me again today because I'm covered with them. That's fine. Intellectual stimulation, if you want to talk hunting and fishing, that's fine. Emotional intimacy, if you want to share your emotions with someone, okay, there's nothing wrong with doing that. If you want to pray with someone else, go ahead and pray with someone else, study with someone else. But when anybody else becomes the primary source of this intellectual, emotional, physical, or spiritual stimulation other than your spouse, your marriage is falling apart. When you say, "I do," you're saying, "I do commit to you." We think about the tragedy of being jilted at the altar. Imagine the shame, the humiliation, the heartache to sit there and know that she's not going to walk down the aisle. And we think that that would be just the most tragic thing about marriage. But God let it happen at the altar and not after the altar. Let it happen right here. Let her leave or let him not show up at this building instead of 5 years down the road or 10 years down the road when there's children involved and the family's going on. So before you allow your "I do" become an "I don't," let's make sure that the commitment we're making to our spouse in those words complements our commitment to God in the end.